Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in, and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored. One of them co-authored with my daughter, The Finality of Jesus Christ. It's a very important book, and if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage, Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of the Epistle to the Romans. We're in chapter 1. We've come to verse 21. But of course, for those of you who weren't with us last time, we do what we normally do. That's reestablish the context so the train can leave the station with everybody on it. Verses 16 and 17 are the theme of the epistle. Paul says he's not ashamed of the gospel because the gospel is a special form of divine energy. It is the power of God for the purpose of salvation, and it is effective for all those who believe. To the Jew first and also to the Greek. The Jews get the first opportunity, but so do all the rest of us. The gospel contains the key to salvation, for in it the righteousness of God. That's what we don't have. That's what we must have in order to be saved. The righteousness of God is revealed to proceed from faith, not from human works or merit. And the righteousness of God is revealed to faith. That is, to those who believe God and embrace it. It is written to confirm that the righteousness of God is a free gift, a legal donation, based upon faith, not upon works. He quotes Habakkuk, where God said, the righteous man shall live. He didn't say by his righteousness, but he shall live by faith. That's the way a man comes to God. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. There is no one who is considered righteous in the sight of God apart from faith. When one comes to Christ by faith, receives the Redeemer by faith, then that person is clothed, legally speaking, in the righteousness of Jesus Christ, and all their sins are remitted, and they have a righteous standing in the sight of God. It is urgent that we preach this gospel. It's urgent that we believe it. Why? Because, whether you realize it or not, folks, the wrath of God is revealed. It's being revealed. He didn't say it was in the past or will be in the future. Both are true. But he wants us to know that the wrath of God right now, this day, in various ways, shapes, and forms, is being revealed from heaven. That just emphasizes that it's a cosmic happening. It's being revealed from heaven, and here are the targets. It's being revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of human beings who have this terrible habit before God and provoke his divine indignation. They suppress the truth about God. They suppress it in their unrighteous behavior. And here's what they do. Because that which is known about God, that which God makes known in their intuitions, read from nature itself, is evident within them. He didn't say it's the dim light of nature. He says it is the clear light of nature. It's evident within them because God made it, phaneros. God made it clear to them. How did he make it clear? Well, he says in verse 20, since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, his power is evident from what he created, and it's also implicit in all that, that this is an eternal being, and his divine nature is expressive of his attributes and some of his moral properties. All these things God equipped us to intuit because they've been clearly seen and they're understood through the things that have been made, that God made. The bottom line is there's nobody out there that has any excuse. Now, before I go on with verse 20, I want to insert here at the end of verse 21, speaking of this phrase, so that nobody's without excuse. You've heard, we've all heard, people ask the question, but what about those who have never heard of Christ? The light that God has given, folks, is sufficient to condemn any and all human beings on this planet in the past, now, and in the future, whether or not they've heard about Christ. Somebody will say, and I understand it, Jim, I don't understand that. I don't understand how anybody could be condemned if they've never been in the position to hear the message of Christ. Well, it's pretty simple when you realize that the light of God may not be truly full in every case, but it is abundant enough and clear enough in every case, based on this scripture, for men to be without excuse. Let me give you a stock analogy that I use all the time. Let's just say a broccoli sprout. That's what you call those little things. I come across people who are dying. They're starving to death. They need nourishment. They need food, sustaining food. All I have with me are a bag of those broccoli heads. That's it. So I go up to them and I said, I will give you what I've got. It's not enough to save you, dear friend, but at least it'll get you going a little ways and we'll see about tomorrow, but today we can take care of this problem. So I pull out a broccoli sprout and I give it to the five people who are starving. A couple of them take it and they want more. But the other three, well, they're like so many people, they hate broccoli. So they spit it out and they won't take it. Now, I could bring in a truckload of broccoli and it wouldn't make a bit of difference to those who rejected it. They don't like broccoli. They won't eat broccoli. Consequently, I gave them enough food, though a small amount, to condemn them. They have no excuses. I offered them food. And if they liked that, I would have gotten them more. But by spitting it out, they told me there was no use to give them the whole bag, today, tomorrow, or any time, because they don't like broccoli. Well, so it is with the light of God, natural revelation. It tells enough about God that men tell on themselves whether or not they care anything for God. And we're about to see as this passage moves on that it is plain and clear with what they did with the light they had that they don't want God in their thoughts, and therefore they condemn themselves. That has been true, that is true, and that will be true forever. So we hear all kinds of theories about, well, those who have never heard, if this, if that, or something else. Friends, this is not the problem that people make it. God says, I didn't say it was not my conclusion. He says that human beings are without excuse. The wrath of God is like a tide rolling, and it will come to a climax when Jesus Christ comes. God, in his holy indignation, is coming against those who, in their ungodliness and unrighteousness, continue to suppress the truth about him. The truth about him, which is not the message of Christ, but other truth about him, his divine nature, his eternal power, all of that which is clearly revealed in nature, so that those who reject it, and that's what the mass of human beings have done throughout history, they are without excuse. To condemn them, they just need to reject the light they have. To save them, they need the light of Christ. But those who will not accept the light they have would not receive the light of Christ. To me, that's not a problem. Now, he begins to explain their inexcusability in verse 21, talking about the human race, paganism, and all of that. For even though they knew God, here's the deal. This is why the wrath of God is there right now. They did not honor him as God, nor did they give thanks. But what human beings did is become futile in their speculations. And as a result, their foolish heart was darkened. Our translations can mislead us here if we assume that this implies that the intuitive knowledge of God, once present, has now been obliterated. All the apostle really intends here is to trace contemporary paganism back to its roots. He shows us first how paganism rejected natural light, then, in the false pretense of religious wisdom, perverted the light that God had given. Noteworthy also in this connection with this present past tense issue is the fact that in verse 30, the author, Paul, reverts to the present tense with respect to man's consciousness of the ordinance of God. Surely this awareness in verse 30, which we're not to yet by any stretch, implies that to whatever extent man's foolish heart was darkened, here in verse 21, that darkening did not, in fact, obliterate all previous knowledge. Back to verse 21, for even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God. Calvin catalogs eloquently the implications reverberating throughout creation which the pagan has refused to acknowledge. I quote, "No conception of God can be formed without including his eternity, his power, his wisdom, his goodness, his truth, his righteousness, and mercy. His eternity is evidenced by the fact that he holds all things in his hand and makes all things consist in himself. His wisdom is seen because he's arranged all things in such perfect order. His goodness is seen because there is no other cause for his creation of all things, nor can any other reason than his goodness itself induce him to preserve them. His justice is evident in his governing of the world, because he punishes the guilty and defends the innocent. His mercy, because he bears the perversity of men with such patience, and his truth, because he is unchangeable." No, though men intuitively knew God in the ways that the context has defined, his eternal power and his divine nature, they did not, and do not, and will not in the future, without a saving work of God, honor him as God. Nor did man give thanks. No wonder they are without excuse. Someone wrote, as God's creature, man was obliged to render glory and thanksgiving to his Creator, still is. And this means not merely to acknowledge his existence, not merely to employ the words and the rites of religiosity, but it means to recognize his sovereignty, his lordship, and to live in grateful obedience. But man has not done that, in spite of the fact that God, through nature, has made his eternal power and his divine nature obvious, clear, transparent. That's why the wrath of God rests right now upon this world, and its target is human beings who suppress the truth in unrighteousness and wickedness. Human beings are not even grateful. They do everything they can to erase God from their consciousness. In all of Paul's writings, a great deal of emphasis is placed upon the duty of thanksgiving. Besides honoring God, thanksgiving is a stimulus to faith. So man is without excuse, because instead of reading the message of nature, they failed to know God as they should have. They did not honor him as God or even give thanks to him. But they became human beings, became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, human beings became fools and exchanged the glory of an incorruptible God for an image, idolatrous images in the form of corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. When it says they became foolish in their speculations, and this is a judgment of God, and their foolish heart was darkened, this is a judgment of God. It went on in the past, it's going on now, and it will in the future. You think of all the neo-paganism that is in the air. You think of the atheism. They became vain in their reasonings. They became out of touch with ultimate reality. Their intentions miscarry. In the words of Barrett, one is not capable of, quote, truly rational thought apart from a relationship with God. Doesn't matter what your IQ is. You can't be truly rational without a right relationship with God. Surely there is a sense in which the whole unbelieving world is befogged in a cloud of insanity. By that I mean out of touch with the truth. That's what insanity is, out of touch with reality about God. The language here, they became foolish in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. The language reflects perhaps a paradox existing in the minds of pagans. By that I mean a seeming contradiction that is best explained, I think, in terms of the conscious and subconscious mind. You see, no matter how hard people try to suppress, and they do try, that intuitive apprehension of God revealed in the Bible we call nature, try to suppress it in their conscious mind, erase it, there remains in the subconscious of every individual an indelible imprint of it. When something terrible happens, you're likely to hear from even an atheist, "Oh, God." In other words, perverted reason suppresses this natural knowledge of God and is held accountable for it. And eventually, as people try to suppress this natural knowledge of God, they succeed in pushing it into the background of their consciousness. But as I say, it is curious how this instinctual awareness of God often leaks around the edges and bolts past the watchpost of surprised and unguarded reason and betrays its hidden presence. I've read a lot of Russian history. I'm no authority. But somewhere, and I don't recall it just now, there's a delicious illustration of the way that happened in the case of Joseph Stalin, who at one time was training to be a priest. Well, it gets worse. Verse 22, professing to be wise, that's what happens. As men profess to be wise and get all swelled up with pride, they became fools. Now, the apostle is not here speaking of philosophers merely, but as Gifford says, the conceit of wisdom which is necessarily connected with the departure from divine truth. He's talking about intellectual pride in general, wherever it exists, and it always makes a fool of its possessor, which is the very point that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 through 31. And it gets worse. In suppressing the truth, thinking they were wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, in the form of birds, in the form of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. All you have to do is go to any encyclopedia or National Geographic magazine, and you find redundantly all kinds of that sort of thing in cultures ancient and modern. Their spiritual obtuseness manifests itself in their idolatrous contradiction of the light of natural revelation. Someone wrote, "When men cease to believe in God, They do not believe in nothing. He said they believe in anything. Boy, do we see that. The stupid, stupid things that otherwise intelligent people believe in is mind-bending. Well, the same can be said for people's worship. When they cease to worship the true God, people do not worship nothing in most cases. They will worship anything, even themselves. The reason for this is repressed intuition of God. It's an instinct as undeniable as a baby's cry. But when it's layered over with unenlightened reasonings, it takes people in the absolute dumbest and most unimaginable directions. You see, man doesn't want God as God. Human beings want to be autonomous. By that we mean self-governing, independent. They want to be unaccountable. I've even read with my own eyes one atheist and a scientist who was honest enough to admit that he did not want there to be a God because they want to be morally unaccountable, and besides, they don't want any competition from a deity of above for the status of gods. So man will reduce God to manageable dimensions, and the way he tries to salvage something that his heart cries for, yet not have to deal with it on terms that he doesn't want to, is to invent himself a God according to his own liking. It's the old principle of trying to have one's cake and eat it too. Folks, even those who don't serve idols in their crasser forms turn out to be idolaters. The idol may be the state. We think of Hitler's Nazi regime. We think of the communist regimes, such as Stalin or such as Mao Zedong in China. It may be the cause. There are all kinds of causes out there today. I think some of the most obvious are what we call nature causes, where people have forgotten their creator and they're all about their creation, and they'll worship trees or they'll worship animals. They put all these things up there as if they were the be-all and end-all, or the party, or the ideology, or with some people their idol is wealth, it's mammon, or it's power. With some people, what they worship, what they want more than anything else, the thing that is more important to them than anything else and will cause them to push all other interests aside when push comes to shove is status. The truth is, human beings always bow to something. They always do, even those who claim they don't. They always bow to something that they enshrine as their authority, as their supreme value, even if it is some worm just like themselves. For that, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. Because in their ungodliness and unrighteousness, men are suppressing the truth about God in their unrighteousness. They know better. God has given them better light, but they try to extinguish that light. They might even succeed consciously, but subconsciously they can't. Even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God, they did not give thanks. But in the end, it always happens that human beings become futile in their speculations, thinking they're so smart, their foolish heart gets darkened, professing to be wise, they become fools. And then they turn the glory of an incorruptible God into an image in the form of corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and beasts. It's a terrible thing, but it happens all the time, in the past, now, and will continue to happen in the future, until Christ comes. Well, dear friends, we'll pick up from there the next time as we further trace out the consequences of this awful situation. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.